Okay, so welcome to the session Divided by Algorithms, Journalism in the Digital Social Machine, hosted by Grimme Institute. My name is Harald Gapski. I'm working at the Grimme Institute and I have the pleasure to moderate this session. Before we dive into the topic today with our two speakers, Karin Bocek from the University of Eichstätt-Ingolstadt and Lara Berger from the University of Cologne. Please let me briefly explain or give some background about the Grimme Institute. It puts things sort of into context. This photo here in the background was taken in April at the Grimme TV Award ceremony. For more than 60 years, the prize has been awarded for exemplary and model-like television in Germany. It has founded in the context of adult education and as an instrument kind of understanding broadcasting in this political culture and civic education context. The Grimme Institute was founded 50 years ago to support this quality award scheme and also developed models of cooperation between adult education and TV. Then in 2001, the Grimme Online Award was launched, which focuses on journalistic quality on the web. And last week we had the award ceremony. As the TV award, there is an elaborated filtering process of hundreds of entries before nominating only a few for the jury. Karin Bocek is a member of the nomination committee, and she can say, I guess, more from the inside about this process. The Grimme Institute is engaged in actually three areas and has five small departments. Of course, the prizes, the TV and online award, but also media qualification for media professionals, the academy, and Grimme, the director here is also in this room, the media education part and the research. And we are shareholders of the Grimme Research College, which is a joint venture with the University of Cologne, and also the Center for Advanced Internet Studies in Bochum. So the term digital social machine actually comes from a fellowship where I was involved in recently, and this ambiguous term serves as a kind of framing concept today. And below you see also the shareholders, the public broadcasters, the state of North Rhine-Westphalia, the regulatory authority among them. Taking up the title of the conference, Overcoming Divisions, today we would like to discuss with you some thoughts and also empirical findings in this context. The term social machine originated from web science and describing kind of these social technological systems in which social interactions are hybrid and partially algorithmized. Examples of social machines are social media platforms, of course, or participatory and crowdsourcing web applications like the Wikipedia, but also the concept of the social machine can be expanded and applied to smart cities or even to the society as a whole. So as a critical metaphor, the social machine can be used to question and reflect upon the phenomena and the processes of societal datafication. The machine is a metaphor in a way for smooth functioning, for rationally comprehensible, uniform, and transparent processes, but equally also for human unfreedom and inflexibility. So my take on the image of the machine is twofolded, as an explanatory model and as a metaphorical reflection, for example, as a tool in media education. The machine concept actually has been applied in many contexts. So last year, for instance, in her keynote here at GMF, Maria Ressa, Nobel Peace Prize laureate, spoke about the hype machine by Sinan Aral, who's a researcher at MIT. And with this machine model, she explained why lies spread up to 6 to 7 times faster than facts from journalistic work. So in this machine model, personalized mass persuasion, hyper-socialization of the always on, and the tyranny of trends are outcomes of this triangle interplay of smartphones, kind of our sensors, and machine learning and social networks. Just to give another example here, well-known and many researchers refer to Shoshana Zuboff's machine of the surveillance capitalism, in which the individual drives a tiny gear wheel in this machine. Be sand in the gears, she demanded as a form of a digital enlightenment. Two more examples, briefly. Nadler et al. Argue, and I quote, that today's digital advertising infrastructure creates disturbing new opportunities for political manipulation, and they call kind of the infrastructure of data collection and targeting capacities the digital influence machine. And on the right, Guy Hasselbalch, who's a member of the EU high-level expert group on artificial intelligence, speaks about the society of the destiny machine, in which everyday algorithms predict our behavior based on what we do and what we have done before, what she quoted. So transferring this kind of machine-like ideas to journalism in the digital age, this sort of machine by Lischka et al. Depicts two interacting and interconnected systems, the classical editorial curated media in blue and the algorithmically curated intermediaries such as Facebook or Twitter in green. Whereas the left, the classic journalistic media system, functions according to journalistic guiding values and also oriented towards public value, on the right, the algorithmic and intransparent functional logic is at work, in which aim is high interaction rates and high attention rates. So user reaction and algorithmic curation process interact with each other. This can develop its own kind of dynamic processes in which, for example, hate speech provoke reactions and attention at the same time serves in its functional logic. But does this model fit the empirical data, for example, in the German media? And how tight is really the linkage between the blue and the green system? And what does journalism research have to say about this? So with that introductory remark, I would like to move on to our first speaker, Karin Wojcik, from the University Eichstätt-Ingolstadt. In general, we have to plan like a 10 minutes roughly input and then questions, and after that, so hopefully the last half hour for open discussion on these issues. So please go ahead. Thank you.
Thanks. We were very surprised about the big crowd. Nice to see you all. I think if you get bored, I think you all have a nice view. This is perfect. So, but I hope I won't. I won't bore you. So I'm speaking to you with several functions. I was a journalist myself, and now I am a journalism researcher, and I'm bringing to you some empirical findings about journalism in the algorithmized world. And I'm also, as Harald already mentioned, I'm part of this commission selecting for this Grimmer Online Award. So we had the luxury of looking at things that other people thought were really good pieces of journalism, and real journalism produced for this world dominated by algorithms already. So I'm going to tell you about both of these functions as my viewpoint as a journalism researcher and also as a member of this commission, and we will look at journalism in these spaces and what is happening to journalism there. And of course, this is a very very German point of view, and I will be very happy to hear from you in the last half hour how you view these things and how you think maybe aspects are very different in other parts of the world. So what I'm looking at as a journalism researcher mainly is how journalism is changed by the spaces that are dominated by intermediaries. So in journalism, we have very traditional players, usually in all parts of the world, that have been there for decades or even longer. And we have got these new players, monopolies, very big enterprises coming into this world and changing the way, or having put other boundaries and affordances, as we call it, to journalism. And journalism has to adapt to that, or partly has to adapt to that. And what I'm looking at is comparing whether or how much journalism actually adapts to these new boundaries that intermediaries put there. So what I wanted to show you first was that there is evidence that journalism is changing, because we see that this is not my research, but others, they look at journalism published in more traditional spaces, for example, websites that are owned by the media companies, so there are no boundaries from other parties there, but they can decide what kind of information they put there and how and which way they want to distribute their journalism, how everything looks, they can decide for themselves. And of course, this is kind of the old world. That was already the case when we had this printed newspapers in the old days. Every journalist or every newsroom, they could decide what kind of information they want to put on top. And everybody, the paper was distributed and everybody had the same newspaper in the streets and everything looked the same to everybody. And of course, this is what changes if we look at the intermediaries, and Facebook is curating with an algorithm what individuals see, and journalists only have play a very, very small part in that and can't decide. This is this difference that we saw with the two kind of bubbles there, with the green and the blue bubble, how things have changed. And what we see now in journalism research is that there is evidence that newsrooms adapt to that and change the way they do their journalism. So they try to put engaging youth on the platform because they think that this is the journalism that works there. This is the journalism that people actually see, because all the other stuff doesn't get distributed by the algorithm. So journalists can put the stuff out there, but nobody's going to see it. So we have some evidence that comparing the content produced on the website to the equivalents published on Facebook, so we have the same news event there, so the objectivity is that the same things happen, but the journalism or the content that is produced based on this news event actually is not the same, but of course it's different. One part of that is it has to be different because Facebook and Instagram put some boundaries how things look like or how things are supposed to look like. And the other thing is that journalists actually actively adapt their content to make it more viral or enlarge the chance it has to be distributed to each individual on the social networks. So we see from journalism research that there are more soft news and there is more emotional news, more subjective news, things that people have a more that are more likely to engage people, so that they actually put comments there, that they like those posts, and so that in this interaction with the Facebook algorithm makes the post more likely to be seen by other people. So this is the viral spiral that is happening there. And another aspect of this more engaging news is that actively people are asked to engage with a post, for example, that they have to say where they are supposed to answer questions, so that there is an interaction happening. Of course, these are all aspects that are not likely to happen in this way on news websites, or not as likely, because journalists decide what's going to be seen by people and not the Facebook algorithm. But for us, this is kind of the basis for my own research as well. And what we see there is that we have this interaction with the algorithms happening to journalistic content. But it's only in journalism research, it's only most of the research done is mostly on Facebook. And we don't really know what is happening with other social media networks. It's kind of always research is mostly lagging behind there. And we wanted to have a look at the new players, so to say, because Facebook is quite old in the social media area. And so what I've brought along is some content or some research we did on other intermediaries as well. So we compared the content published by media houses not only on Facebook and but also on Instagram, on TikTok and on Twitter. So we always compared the content they publish on their websites with the equivalents on these four social media networks. And what we did here, and this is also very very important to notice, that we only looked at quality players in Germany. So all the brands you see in this little bubble on the left, these are all kind of elite or paper of records newsrooms that are not the the default and not kind of, it's not it's not not every newsroom is like that. So it's all kind of quality brands we are looking at. And kind of our idea was whether we can find this changing and adapting to social media platforms also in areas where we hope we don't find it, right? So that our idea was to prove that maybe there is some guys out there who are holding their journalistic values as more important than the adaption to social media platform algorithms. So this is what we did. We compared the website content of these brands to their output on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok, and looked at the way things are changed there. And what's very important to note there is that only a very small fraction of the content distributed on the websites is distributed via social media platforms as well. So one important finding was that if you're looking at the content of a media brand you trust and you only look at their Instagram page, for example, you get considerably less information than the people looking at the website. So this is a very important finding if you decide, okay, what kind of way do I want to get my information? If you're choosing social media over the classic website or the classic distribution channels, you are probably going to get less information. So this is one important finding. But what was very important, if we are looking only at the content distributed via social networks, it was not the case where we only saw soft news. No, that was not a significant finding. So it's just that they choose content from the website and you get less information, but the information you get for these quality media brands was not biased in a way that was more emotional or more soft news or more opinion generating, so more engaging content as we saw in my first slide with a research that was already done. And the other thing is that we didn't see any tweaking in the direction of personalization or interaction features like asking people what they think and so generating content comments like this. So that was something that was not happening in our sample. So what's very important for me to know to note for you is that we have this we have evidence that this is happening, that journalism and journalistic content is adapting to the boundaries set by social media platforms. But it's very important to note that this is not happening for every news brand in every part of the world, in every country. So I just want to caution with being like panicking in this area. So this is not what's happening there. But it's very important that you, if you're a regulator or if you're educating children on media, it's very important to consider what kind of brand you follow and where you follow it, depending on what kind of or the quality of information you want to get. So this is very important. And so just to stress that again, that is this is really the kind of this is an exception because we only looked at this for quality media brands, and there we weren't able to see that the content was tweaked in a way that is more emotional and more soft news. So for these quality media brands, it was just not true. But we don't know whether like what about all the other scenarios in other countries. And another kind of positive way I want to end my little part is that I will tell you a few things about the work from the nomination committee I worked on for the Grimme Online Award. And of course, this is also a very biased sample of journalism we looked at. This is journalism made for algorithmized spaces, made for Instagram, made for TikTok. But this is also content that was already filtered by other people who told us, okay, this is good quality content. You should consider it for an award. So this is not the regular content there. And what we see there, and we're looking at this content and picking things that should be nominated for the award, is that we really see in the spaces that are made for engaging content and making viral content, that we see content there, journalistic content, that is really an addition to voices usually heard in Germany, because it's other topics, it's other people, it's other sources that we don't regularly see in German journalism. And so this is something that's really diversifying content in German journalism. And I will show you two examples of this. On the left-hand side, Bruder Steff, this is a guy educating Germans about their colonial history and everything happening in the big continent of Africa. And this is something that is not regularly happening in German journalism. And this is happening on TikTok, and this is only happening because this is a very low barrier for him to do this, and he can do, this is not his main job, but he's just doing that because he thinks it's important. And this is really reaching a lot of people now. Yeah, and the other example is this platform for people who cannot talk, and they are I don't know how Gebärdensprache, anyone. Sign language, thank you so much. How they are using sign language to distribute journalistic content. This is something that is not happening in this way in journalism before in Germany. And now we've got this Instagram page, and they are reaching a lot of people doing this. And so these are two examples that showing that these spaces dominated by algorithms can also produce really high quality content, making it available for a lot of people. But it's also important to know that we have to be really cautious what is happening, not in this quality area, like the kind of really these spaces that are already like awards places, but also like what is happening if we are looking at the broader things, what's happening at a large scale. And we see that algorithms are focusing people or are making people doing things that they usually wouldn't do. And I think this is something that Lara is going to talk about, how incentives are changing if we have a space that is not a classic journalistic place anymore.
Yeah, thank you very much, Karin Bocek. Are there directly related questions to her presentation before we move on? Oh, three. I saw a hand over there.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the presentation. My name is Timo. I work for DW Academy. I have a question to you, which is like, of course, you know, if you have new media, then the content and journalism is going to adapt to new media, right? Print is different from radio, is different from online, is different from TV. But in everything you presented here, I kind of heard this underlying assumption that it's automatically bad if it is on social media. And to me, that didn't become apparent from the presentation you showed there. And so I was just wondering, because you know, you're also saying like, oh, there's quality journalism, they're doing a great job, they're not adapting it. And you also said like, so we don't need to be panicky. So I'd just like to know a little bit more about like, why is your underlying assumption that it has to be, that it's automatically bad if it happens on social media? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for this question. I think this is my maybe biased way of transporting it, because this is the reaction I always get if I'm talking about, because I'm working, like my job description is digital journalism, and I'm telling people, okay, I'm focusing on the interaction between social media and journalism. And what's happening there all the time to me is people telling me, okay, yeah, but on Instagram, there's only soft news and like cat pictures and that's it. And why are you like investing your time in doing this? And so my, maybe this is a biased view, but this is the reaction I always get. And so lots of people are thinking that everything happening on social media is bad. And this is the way I'm, this is the reason why I'm framing it like this, but because lots of people are really afraid of the influence of social media on well-being and disinformation, all things happening, I think. And there's good reason to be skeptical as well, but I think it's, this is the way I'm, the reason why I'm framing it like this, yeah.
Is there, yes.
Hi. I'm Patricia from Kenya. I work for an organization called Odipo Dev. And our organization is a mix of journalists, researchers, and culture analysts. And we've currently embarked on a project where we are creating content which is 100% on TikTok, on something called Vibecast. And there's a lot that you've said that has piqued my attention. One of the things that you mentioned was the traditional media takes only 40% to 1% of its content to the social media platforms. So I'm curious to see, have you identified any particular patterns in identification of the type of content which they would move to social media as opposed to that they leave on the website? And the second question I have is, you mentioned high quality content. I'm very curious to understand, what was your definition of that? How different is that content from other types of content on platforms?
The first question, that was so interesting to us that we didn't see any significant patterns from the variables we looked at, like opinions or different topics, like police reporting on one of us, or like politics or entertainment. We looked at different topic categories and we didn't see anything that was specifically selected for social media. But what we didn't look at, and we are going to look at in the future, is whether content is produced only for social media. That is not, that doesn't have any corresponding item on the website level, because what we looked at was like the website or the classic channel as a starting point, and we looked at transfer to social media. And so I can't say anything about content specifically produced for social media and how this might be different from the content regularly done by the newsrooms. To social media? No, there wasn't a pattern. We didn't find any pattern from all the variables we looked at. It wasn't specifically entertainment content. It wasn't soft news content. It wasn't content that was dominated by like opinion pieces, like telling people like what they are supposed to think about something. But we didn't find any pattern there, and that was very surprising to us. Yeah. And you have to remind me of a second. High quality. And that was something that we found an easy way out there, because we only looked at newspapers or outlets that other people have defined for as high quality in journalism, like beforehand. So, yeah. So this is not something that we worked on. Yeah.
So thank you. I'd like to move on to our second speaker, Lara Berger from the University of Cologne. And she's done some experimental work in the economics field, so I'm happy to have you here, and please.
Yeah, thanks a lot. It's great to be able here to speak with you. So this is me. I'm a doctoral candidate at the University of Cologne, and today I want to talk about one particular project and present some evidence that I found in that project that I think is kind of related to the overall topic that we looked at. In this project, I looked at how the digitization of media markets shifts the emotionality of news headlines. So it really focuses only on this dimension of emotionality, but I think just to have one thing to focus on, it's a good, an interesting starting point. So the idea behind this is that journalism in general has a natural tendency to focus on sensationalist content. So what do I mean by this? Well, think about the example that usually nobody reports about a plane that arrives on time, right? But if there's something super positively happening, say a baby is born on a plane and everything goes well, or something super negative, say a plane crash, then of course people are going to report about this. And probably this is also due just to the natural tendency of people telling stories that are kind of something sensational and not something that happens every day. So I think probably most journalists here know this better than I do. Now, interestingly, the digitization comes with some incentives that might actually enhance this form of bias. So in this, with this tendency, it's kind of not, journalism is not super representative for reality, right? Because most planes just arrive on time. And this kind of tendency might be enhanced by digitization due to some shifts in incentives. So first of all, each headline in the online world, for example, is in competition with thousands of other headlines. In the offline world, the front page is in competition with other front pages usually, right? If we think about a printed newspaper. Also, in the online sphere, journalists receive immediate feedback. So they get some information about click rates, about shares on social media, on some comments. People can ask questions and so on and so forth. And they can also learn better maybe what people like or how they react to their stories. Also, ad revenues can directly depend on click rates, especially if we think about social media. So, for example, if somebody is a YouTuber and produces content there, they get their revenue depending on how many people are actually watching this video. Okay, and so how did I try to tackle this question? So, with a threefold approach. So, first, I compared some headlines from online and offline news outlets. So I always compare the same outlet. It's a sample which I will show you in a second, of German outlets. But I have the online and the offline version and just looked at differences in terms of emotionality. And then I also conducted an experiment with some professional journalists and also with some readers, right? Because it's also, of course, interesting to see if there's some difference. How does this translate into reactions and beliefs of readers? So let's talk about this first part first. So this is the analysis about online versus offline headlines. And this is just a summary of the sample. Okay, so the pointer doesn't work. But so these are just five outlets, so it's not super representative for the German media sphere. But what I think is quite nice about the sample is that it's kind of diverse, because we have some tabloid outlet built, then we have some outlets which are considered more high quality, like Der Spiegel, Die Zeit, Die Welt, Rheinische Post. Then we have some regional newspapers, Rheinische Post, and some nationwide newspapers, the first four of them. We have a few which are more towards the political right, like Die Welt or Bild, or a few which would be more considered towards the political left, like Der Spiegel or Die Zeit. So it's kind of, not just one specific outlet. And the reason I chose those, by the way, are just because these were the ones where I had data available, which was clearly separated by online versus offline. So it's not that I chose just them for some specific reason or something like that. And what I did with these headlines of these newspapers was to classify them. So I trained a machine learning model that classified them into three different classes. First, they were just separated in being either a positive headline, a neutral headline, or a negative headline. And then, just that you understand the results afterwards better, I will also talk about something being emotional or not emotional. And when I talk about a headline being emotional, I mean that it has been classified as either positive or negative. And if I talk about a neutral headline, it has been classified as neutral. And this is the main finding of this analysis. So here on this left side, you see the means of the offline and online headlines in terms of emotionality. So you can see this dot, which is close to the 0.4. So this means that around, I think, 38% or roughly 40% of the headlines offline has been classified as emotional. At the same time, online, these are roughly 60%. So this is a substantial difference, right? So, and if we then look at these three different classes, which is here on the this other side, we can have the gray bars, which refer to the offline headlines, and the white parts in the back, the white bars in the back, which refer to the online headlines. And there you can see that this bar, the white bar, is bigger in the negative and in the positive column, right? And This means that online headlines are more often both negative and more positive. So there's not just more negativity online than offline, but it's more emotionality than offline. Offline, this gray bar is much larger, right, which is the share of the offline headlines which have been classified as neutral. And this finding is actually quite robust. So I also looked at a subset of matched articles, which means just the same article that was published online versus offline, right? Because not every article was published offline, not every article was published online. And there a similar difference exists. I also looked at non-economic headlines. So the results that I showed you in the beginning was mainly about economic news, but then I also retrieved some more data about non-economic news, so general news, and there's also a similar difference. I also looked at headlines of the New York Times just to have a non-German news outlet and see whether this is a particularly German pattern. It doesn't seem to be. And also I used other classification methodologies, and I could find similar results with different classifiers, so it doesn't seem to be driven by this machine learning classifier that I had trained. And also, it's quite robust over time, so it's nothing that is driven by a specifically emotional period of time or something like that in the data. It's just very stable, a difference between online and offline, and online headlines are, on average, more often emotional in most of the times in the sample. Okay. So now I was interested in the question of why this could be the case, right? And to do this, I conducted a small experiment with some journalists. So these were 200 full-time journalists that were recruited via the biggest German journalist association. So they worked for outlets from the entire political spectrum. This was an online experiment, so they could participate on their computer or their smartphone, and they had a wide big age range, so from 18 to 80, and also connected to that quite different work experience. And this is the main design that I used in this experiment. So what these people had to do, these journalists, they had to choose a headline, which could be either positive, neutral, or negative, for a given article about the German economy. So everybody had the same article, they just had to choose the headline. And they were randomized into two groups. So there was a control group, which just received a flat payment for their participation, so some monetary amount for deciding on that headline, while there was a treatment group, which was paid per click on the headline. And these journalists were randomly allocated to these groups. And therefore, those in the treatment group had a much stronger incentive to have a headline that would be popular with the audience afterwards. And this is the main finding of this experiment. And actually, it looks quite similar, right? So here we can see that the journalists in this flat rate group, roughly 40% of them chose an emotional headline, while over 60% in this pay-per-click group chose an emotional headline. So those in the pay-per-click group much more often chose an emotional headline than those in the flat rate group. And then if we look at the distribution in terms of whether it was negative or positive or neutral, it's again a similar picture. So in this pay-per-click group, these economic incentives to generate clicks really made journalists choose more often a positive or a negative headline, in contrast to those who didn't have such strong incentives. Okay, so does this do anything with readers, right? This is, I think, also a very important question. So far, I have only some evidence from an experiment that I conducted with some student participants. They were also randomly exposed to one of the three headlines from this journalist experiment. And the main result was, or the two main results of this small experiment were that those who read an emotional headline had beliefs that were more distorted from the content in the article. So they really seemed to pay attention to the headline because the article was always the same, right? And those in the who read the positive or the negative headline either over or underestimated the facts that were reported in the article, actually. And also those who read a positive headline stated to feel better. So I think there are some caveats that one should keep in mind with these results that I just presented. So in this news data set in the beginning, of course, there are no causal claims possible, right? So I compared online versus offline headlines, but it doesn't necessarily mean that this difference exists because it's online. So this is something that one should keep in mind with that. And also, I only looked at the dimension of headline sensationalism, right? So as we heard before, there are many other possible dimensions, which probably would also be very interesting. And with the experiments, I so far could only test one topic. I'm actually working at the moment on testing a more diverse set of articles and headlines and so on and so forth. But this is also some limitation that you should keep in mind. And it were only German journalists, and also the sample of readers were students of our university, right? So they are not super representative, and there might be differences if we have a very representative sample. Okay, this has been my results, but yeah, maybe somebody has a question or a comment or something like that.
Hi, thank you so much. I would like to know what is the data that you use for training the machine learning? Yeah, basically that.
Mm-hmm. So you mean this, does it work with this microphone as well? Okay. So you mean this model that classified it into these three classes, right? So I used the first, a pre-trained model, which was trained on a large data set from online data. So the basic infrastructure is called BERT. And which is a large language model, and then it was trained on news data into classifying this into these three different classes. And then I fine-tuned it in order to have it really be accurate in terms of headlines, because most of these models are a bit better in classifying larger parts of text or larger chunks of text. And for this, I had two student assistants, who were very helpful in classifying a subset of headlines, so I think it were 3,000 of my headlines, into these different classes. And so the overlap between the two different students was quite okay. So I think they had like 80 or 85% agreement on whether a headline was positive or not. And this I used to fine-train the model afterwards. So of course this is always a bit subjective, right? Saying whether a headline is positive or negative or neutral. Therefore, I also decided to not have some more fine-grained classification in terms of very negative, negative, neutral, or something like this, because this would become even more subjective. And I decided that, okay, probably these three different classes are kind of a good balance somehow, because, yeah, I mean, it's always a kind of a subjective concept, but I think most people agree on whether something is super neutral or negative or something like that. But there might be some headlines where it's a bit ambiguous. Thank you.
So thank you very much for this presentation. Since we have heard now two research findings from the German media landscape, we are very interested to hear about your thoughts on that, and therefore we thought it would be a good idea to ask, first of all, who is actively working as a journalist in your countries? May you raise your hand, please? Who is a journalist? And how do you relate? Can we click one more to the...
Sure.
These findings we have presented, does this match your experience in your national environment, in your media landscape, or how do you see any differences between the experiences you have? So basically the question here is, does the findings match with your experiences, or how, when you, in your working environment, how data-driven, how algorithmically influenced is the work you are doing in your media context? Have a thought on that?
Break the ice by just asking Ms. Berger exactly the percentage of the headlines.
Do you want to use the microphone?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Thanks, Benjamin Bartke. I work for the Global Media Forum. Oh. So can you just remind me what's the percentage again of the negative, well, more emotional headlines that were online? So I didn't, Was it 60% or?
Online, 60% of the headlines were classified 60%. As emotional.
Yeah, yeah.
And offline, it were like 38%.
38% versus 60. Yeah. Okay, that's it. Thank you very much.
But there was a hand raised.
I mean, I worked at a TV station in the United States, and your findings match about 100% of what we do. And it's a small newsroom I have, and I work on the digital side of things, and we test headlines. We have got like experiments that run on the front of our websites, which show different people different headlines, and we try to maximize for the most clicks, and we also try to think every day about how to get people to click into the article. And I came to this meeting because my issue lately is because our traffic from Facebook has fallen off the cliff. There's no way to get traffic from TikTok, from Instagram, from anything else, and Twitter isn't just a mess. And so I'm trying to fight that. And you know, Facebook fired its entire news team. So it's like, well, we've done all this work and tried to get all these people to click. And we tried to be the best at social media, and social media gave up on us. And now what do we do? So yeah, you got us.
Thank you. Any other comments or experiences? Or
thank you. I'm Mariana Galvez. I'm from Peru. And what I find from the, I was actually surprised with the findings of the first research, because I believe that in the Global South, they would be much more dramatic. In my experience working in TV mainly, but we would translate this news into also online articles, the change is very drastic, to the point that sometimes we would have articles on Twitter or on Facebook that is just, look at this cute little doggy and what he did on to his mom or something. And you click on the article and the only thing on that page is a video. And it's mostly interns, at least in Peru, mostly interns that work the night shift that are expected from their boss to post 20 articles on their shift. And it's mainly articles like this that are created only for social media and that almost have no relation to what's on print if it's a newspaper. So I'm very curious to what a similar research like this, if made on somewhere like Peru or at other Latin American countries. I believe in African countries have a similar media landscape. I'm curious to the results, if it would match the German study, or how different would they be?
Thank you. Would you like?
Yeah, just really quick. We were very surprised as well that they didn't find any significant findings with this corresponding things. But this is, I just want to say that again, that we haven't focused on content that was only published on social media yet. And this is what we are doing with this data set, and looking at the things that have no corresponding item published on the website, and analyzing this content, because I think this is also a very important aspect to look at, that the things that are specifically and only produced for social media and what's happening there. So this is a very important thing that modern journalism research should focus on. Yeah.
I think I would reiterate my colleague's point. What I've seen by observation, again, we also don't have the research, so I'd love to see what it looks like in Africa. But what I've seen is that what happens is the people who sensationalize the headlines or the stories are actually very separate from the actual media. So it's like other people who've created like independent media houses, they'll take the headline from the main newsrooms, and then they'll completely sensationalize it and get way more traction online than the actual newsroom that actually got the story in the first place. So that's what I'm seeing happening on our side. For the thing for finding out what it looks like on a social media only platform, I would love you guys, like once we've done this for a year or so, because Vibecast is very new, we actually come and see what the learnings are. Like, yeah, from a TikTok-based only platform. I think that would be really interesting. Yeah.
Yes, thank you.
Hello. I work as a communications advisor at Maastricht University, so it's the university environment, and researchers are more and more asked to share their research, and often, as you know, in academia, titles are really non-emotional, let's say, and to the point of being like totally non-clickable. So in science communication, what we call science communication, but also even that term is, we're calling it public engagement. You know, so we encourage researchers to engage with the public, and in doing so, changing the very jargon, technical, boring title, or completely ununderstandable in many times academic title, into something more journalistic, but much more emotional. So, like, how do you recognize a liar? This will never be, you know, a headline of an academic. I mean, it's not usually. But now this is the type of title that researchers are being encouraged to use in order to, I mean, if they're going to try to get someone to read their academic paper, and they're trying to promote that on social media. So I was wondering if this is also something that that you notice, that academics are also going into the sentiment, you know, realm.
I can only tell you, for like journalism research, there are already papers published with emojis in there. And so this is kind of course, this is on a meta level, because there's like people working on like audience engagement, and they are doing headlines of scientific papers made in a way like a social media post. So from my point of view, I can only say that it's already there, like from my discipline. But I think where I can see that people are already using it in a way, like fun way, and like in a meta way, and not taking it too serious. But I think it's a dangerous path if we are doing everything like that. Yeah, it's and I don't have a recommendation. And science is also very engagement, or like we are also paying a lot of attention to like how many times was my paper cited, and how many times was it distributed on Twitter, and how many people clicked it, and how many people downloaded it. And all of us in like academic careers are also very like focused on systems that are based on algorithms, like Google Scholar pushing like specific like papers to the top. And so yeah, we are not much better in academia, I think, than journalism is. Yeah.
Maybe I could add like just one aspect. I think there might also be a trade-off, right? So this experiment with the readers that I just showed was showing that people kind of recall the information worse if it's very emotional, in the sense of not remembering facts as well. But if the alternative to this is just not reading anything because it seems so boring, then maybe it's better to just read this a bit of emotionalized headline, right? And get some content. So, this is also something that I would like to understand better. Like, how can we balance those two forces, right? Because the answer cannot be, well, let's do just everything extremely boring and it will be accurate, but nobody's going to read it. So,
I just wanted to add something there, because I think that's something that, like when I'm talking about those things, I'm already like, as someone already said, I'm going to be quite negative talking about that. But what we always see is that, people who are like actively saying that they want information, that are always like, although those like we have those like aspects we have to think about, and like getting more emotional headlines and balancing those things out, but I think what's more important is people saying that they don't want any information at all, and they don't want to read anything at all, and that they don't want to participate in the democracy and in society. And I think that's more dangerous than people like being very tired and clicking on a very emotional cat video. I think that's something that's okay to a certain point. So this is all about balance. And I think I worry, when I'm worrying about those things, I'm more worrying about people who are avoiding news at all. Yeah,
thank you very much. Since we are working at the Grimme Institute and we have been involved in this debate on quality,
with the prizes, the Grimme Online Award and the TV prize, of course the term quality is in the core of our discussions, and we'd love to hear more about your thoughts on how does the discourse on quality changes with these kind of interaction of this system, of this algorithmically edited and curated system and the human editorial system. I know defining quality is like nailing a pudding on the wall, that's kind of a saying, but maybe you have a final thought or comment on the influence this kind of media world has on the quality discourse. Yes, please.
Hi, I'm Alex. I'm with DW, but I'm a freelancer and I'm not a journalist anymore. I work with an R&D team. And I guess I'm a dinosaur. I've been using social media for like 20 years. So enough about me. So back to the quality thing. My question would be, how can we get back to something that deserves the label quiet quality, maybe? I mean, I get why people are on TikTok, and it's a good thing that the public broadcasters are on TikTok because they say fish where the fish are, but there are some issues you just cannot explain in, I don't know, a one-minute bit or a two-minute bit or whatever. So is there a way backwards? Do you know what I mean? Like, can we use like the Fediverse, an open platform, make that smart, attractive, sexy for younger audiences? Or do we have to compete with this? Bigger, better, faster, more cuts, dance moves, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's important to be there, and Tagesschau is there as well. But there's only so much you can convey in such a short amount of time. So that's the question. How do we go back to quiet quality in an attractive way?
Question for everybody. We have. I don't know who was first.
We have 2 more minutes, I guess.
Yeah, I just wanted to respond to my colleague. I think there's ways. There are TikTok formats where you use multiple part videos, so you still have a short 1 minute video. But maybe you divide it in parts so it's still exciting to talk about a topic that deserves more more information. But then you divide it in sort of episodes, and it still fits the TikTok format, and it will still like grab attention on the algorithm. And TikTok now has longer videos, 3 minutes. Yeah, it's still a Chinese platform, but well, we could discuss that with every Facebook, Instagram. The issues about around data, I think that's a whole another topic. But if we talk about like making use of the format and the platform, I think there's already some ways that we could make a use of it and still like dive in deeper to the topics we need to talk about.
I would just like to add, because precisely when we were talking about choosing the media, the best media quality outlets, we were talking about mostly traditional media, which we have seen historically that there are so many times that they are neglected, all of the voices that are making part of a society. So in terms of media quality, what social media brings is diversity. So you can, as we see earlier, many people don't have too much limits in order to publish what they think, which of course we know that it's also like has pros and cons, but it's like nowadays by having more diversity, pluralism in our social media, that I can reach so many many information that before I was not able to do because they didn't have these platforms. I think it's very important in what it comes to have a media quality media outlet.
Yeah, thank you very much. Keep the discourse open with quality, with more diversity, and with new formats also the quiet ones. Thank you very much for your participation. Thank you very much, our speakers here, Lara Berger from the University of Cologne, Karin Gocek from the University of Eichstätt, Ingolstadt, and thank you very much for participating, and have a good day.
Nee, alles gut. Mir zumindest nicht aufgefallen.
Ja,
wunderbar. Da waren aktive Diskussionen und so, ne? Ja, ja, also die Raum sind wieder da, die waren viele Kopf. Genau.